Let's talk about Riverside.fm, the leading podcast and video creation platform that's changing the game on how creators record content. Riverside.fm allows you to record studio quality audio and up to 4K video on their platform. Now you can interview a guest 1,000 miles away and it'll sound like you're sitting in the same room. It's as easy to use as Zoom, but gives much higher quality audio and video recordings. Did we mention that they have a mobile app? This allows guests to connect directly from their phone and record content from anywhere. After your content is finished, you can easily grab clips to share them across your social media channels. So if you're looking for a hero platform for all your recording needs, from podcasts to webinars to other video content, you should be using Riverside FM. Sign up today so you can focus on your content and leave the quality to Riverside FM. Use promo code SHIPIT and receive a 30% discount on your first 3 months of your subscription. That's promo code SHIPIT to receive a 30% discount on the first 3 months of your subscription. Back to the show. Welcome to another episode of the City That Never Sleeps podcast. I'm Josh and I am joined by my co-host Alex. Obviously, if you are listening to this when we release it on Friday, or if you're not listening to it when we release it on Friday and you're listening over the weekend, hope you had a great Labor Day weekend last week and hope you're enjoying your weekend this weekend. And we're excited to get into it. This week, in this episode, I will be talking about two player profiles and projections, which I want to give credit to Talking Giants and John Boymita, who had the idea, and we're kind of using that to help us out. So I wanted to give credit to them. Alex, hopefully next episode we'll have that. And, Alex, school starting tomorrow when we're recording this. How are you doing? How are you feeling? And, why are you too lazy to, have two players and do a PPP for the Nets?
I'm doing well. My laziness is doing well as well, double well, triple, like five wells at this point. I'm excited to be here. I'm going to ignore your comment for now. We'll have some Nets PPPs next episode. I'm a 5-year-old.
Yeah, laughing at PPP. Okay. So basically, Alex has some Nets news that he's got to get into that, of course, we missed a day after our episode release. So we'll go into that first. We'll go into the two Knicks PPPs. It's going to be fairly short for each player. Obviously, I don't know if you're going to see it in the title of this episode. Maybe it's in the description. But it's the two new signings, Kemba Walker, Evan Fournier. And I felt like if I was going to do PPPs for a few players, I don't know if I'm going to get to all of them on the roster, but I would like to at least start with the two big free agent signings that the Knicks made, with Kemba Walker and Evan Fournier. And then we will end this podcast with the very own Nets and Knicks trivia section and questions, which we'll get to in a little bit. Alex, what's the Nets news you got for us?
So we're going to go in chronological order. So first thing that happened was the Nets re-signed LaMarcus Aldridge. He had consulted with his doctors, etc., did whatever he had to do, and decided to come back to the Brooklyn Nets. He will be replacing, now we'll get to the next piece of news here, DeAndre Jordan. Bit an issue, not been my favorite player at the Nets, but he is gone now. The Brooklyn Nets have acquired forward Sekou Doumbouya and center Jahlil Okafor from the Detroit Pistons in exchange for center DeAndre Jordan, second round picks in 2022, 2024, 2025, and 2027, and cash considerations. Doumbouya, 6'8", 230 pounds, appeared in 94 games across his first two seasons in the NBA, 2019-2021, I believe was the 15th pick for the Pistons, averaged 5.6 points per game, two and a half rebounds a game, in around 17 minutes per game. Can't speak today. Okafor, 6'10", 270 pounds.
Sure it's not Okafor?
Okafor. 6'10", 270 pounds. Has seen action in 247 games, 116 starts in 6 seasons with Detroit, New Orleans, and Brooklyn, where he was back in 2017. Kind of funny that he's back. And Philadelphia in 2015, averaging 10 points a game, 5 rebounds in about 20 minutes per game. And that's it for that bit there. And also, actually, I skip chronological order as well. Paul Millsap also signed for the Nets on a 1-year deal. Kind of a downgrade. Poor man's Jeff Green at this point in his career. But still a nice piece to hopefully come back, come and help the Nets here. And I think, sorry for butchering the name, but Domboya, I think, will be a really nice piece for the Nets, and I'm hoping that he can really show his potential in Brooklyn.
Yeah, and Alex and names aren't his strong suit. They don't go well together, as if you don't know, now you know. And we should have mentioned this in the beginning. No, the name you are not reading in the title that we have an interview with is wrong, or we're joking about it. We actually do have an interview with Ian Eagle coming up for you in a little bit, so stay tuned for that. We are really excited. And yes, that is the Brooklyn Nets play-by-play broadcaster, NFL on CBS, March Madness, and much more. So stay tuned for that. It was a very exciting interview. I guess we're ready for the PPPs? Player, profile, projection. So we have Kemba Walker, the player who has spent most of his time with the Charlotte Hornets and some other teams as well. The man who actually grew up in New York, was actually spotted recently with a Boogie with the Hoodie, the rapper, at a Yankees game the other day. So that's exciting. He's getting used to the New York culture that he once spent time in anyway. Now, Kemba is an interesting player because as the years have gone on, he's kind of gone down, as most players do when it comes to, I guess, production, I should say. So most of his time in the NBA has been with the Charlotte Hornets, and I guess I can start out with there. Kemba Walker, who is in fact 31 years old, he is 6 foot, and was drafted with the 9th pick in the first round of the NBA draft. Started his career with the Charlotte Hornets, and I'm just trying to get up his numbers here for all the teams that he spent time with, and that was the Boston Celtics, first of all, this past 2 seasons. Okay. Charlotte Hornets, now I have it. 19 or about 20 points per game, about 34 minutes per game, and his field goal percentage in his entire career is about 42 field goal percentage, 4 rebounds a game, 5 assists a game. In his most productive season with the Charlotte Hornets, probably was when he played and averaged about 23 points per game in 35 minutes. Field goal percentage was about 44%, and he had about 6 assists a game. And actually, he had, he averaged about 26 points per game in his 2018 season for the Charlotte Hornets, which was his last year with the team. Since that point, it's gone down from 20 to 19 points per game in his final season with the Boston Celtics, although he only played about 43 games with the Boston Celtics in 2020 compared to 50 compared to then 82 in 2018, played every single game, then 80, 79. So, you know, this past season, I guess, doesn't show really all of, you know, Kemba and his potential that he can have with the New York Knicks. Now, here's the deal when it comes to the knee injury. Now, he sustained a knee injury. It's been a nagging knee injury. And that's just the worry when it comes to Kemba, because this could be re-injured. Obviously, he says I'm 100% now, but we'll have to see. But I also think he also suffered, I think it was, so he suffered the left knee injury before last season, and he is suffering from a type of arthritis that could greatly impact his 2021-2022 season. So that's a big thing, but hopefully he should be fine. So that is Kemba Walker. His projections coming from me, I think Kemba Walker, this is the big one, games. I think that's a big one for Kemba Walker. And obviously we know Tom Thibodeau with back-to-backs, he said in the press conference that he would let him do so, as well as, I think playing injured, he might let him do. So I'm going to go 68 games for Kemba Walker. I think that's a fair assessment. I think that he'll miss 14 games this season with injury or sitting out or whatever it is.
It is. And I think that Kemba will have a pretty good season. The four-time All-Star and the 2018-19 All-NBA will have that good of a season. Now, on to our next player, Evan Fournier. This is my player profile and projection for him. He's 28 years old. He is 6'7". He was the first round 20th pick in the 2012 NBA draft. And Fournier, I think, will have a productive season as well with the New York Knicks. Spent his time mostly in Orlando, but obviously played in Denver as well in the beginning of his career, and then ended up in Boston last season. His points started out with 38 games in his first season in 2012, averaged about 5 points per game. And his best season came in Orlando in the last season with Orlando too, kind of just like Kemba. 19.7 or 20 points a game, basically, in 30 minutes, about 3 rebounds and 4 assists per game. That was his highest points per game in a season. Although for that season, he only played about 26 games. In the 2020 season, he only played 16 games. And this also has to do with the injury troubles for Evan Fournier too. Now, everyone gets injured. A lot of players, that's just how it works. They get injured. But hopefully it should be different with these two players for the Knicks. Now, once again, I don't know how Tom Thibodeau is going to handle these players. If he's going to want to like sit them out, if they're just like because of lingering injuries. Like that's my worry, is that they have lingering injuries and it just stays and stays and stays and they don't play. But hopefully that won't be the case. And so I'm just trying to find the injury history. Here we go. For Evan Fournier, the injury history consists of a ankle injury, sprained left MCL, sore foot, sore ankle, and obviously the knee injury being the most impactful. He actually didn't play against the Knicks, and I think a few games last season. I remember because he missed it, and they ruled him out for a game late. But I think that's going to be it for his profile. And now I will go on to my projection. So this past season, obviously, averaged about 17 points per game. I'm going to say he averages about 16 points per game. Kemba averages about 19 points per game. Evan Fournier, he plays, I think, more games than Kemba. I think he plays 76 games. That's a bold statement. And I don't know if he will do that. But I think Fournier, with the style of play that he does, obviously he will help at that shooting guard spot. But hopefully he's able to play that many games. So now in his career, the only time he has surpassed 70 games was 3 times. It was in the 2013 season, he played 76 games. 2015 season, he played in 79 games. And 2018, he played in 81 games. Now, he's played it in 10 seasons in the NBA. So I guess that's not, you know, that's a little troubling, but it is what it is. And we will have to see what he does here. Alex, you've been very silent for a while. Do you have anything to say about either of these PPPs for both Kemba Walker and Evan Fournier?
I think Fournier is going to have a bigger role. I think he's really going to be kind of that number two guy behind Randall, or, you know, kind of with Randall as that, you know, number two, because Randall's not really a number one, if we're being completely honest, or at least not the person you want to rely on only. Kemba, I think, is there almost more of like a he'll play when he's ready and play when he can kind of role because of his injury history. I'm not sure if he's going to be as big of a part of the team. I think I see him more in a Derrick Rose type of role, what Derrick Rose did for you last season. Maybe a little bit less game time.
And Derrick Rose is still on this New York Knicks team. So I would say it's a very exciting time in I guess, Knicks land. I was actually looking at, I wish I could find it, but I was looking at like an article about the systems that the Knicks can run when it comes to lineups. And they do have a lot of combinations that they can work with. If they wanted to have a starting lineup of Kemba Walker, Evan Fournier, RJ Barrett, Julius Randle, and Mitchell Robinson, there still is a bench there. And that bench starts with Derrick Rose right now coming right off the bench. then leading to, I mean, you could say Emmanuel Quickly. And if they don't start Evan Fournier, he can come off the bench too. So I think that's a big deal. And I mean, obviously we have Obi Toppin in there as well, the young player. We had a few players this off season, or I should say throughout the summer league, that showed up. Jericho Sims, Miles McBride, Deuce McBride, as everyone calls him, and Quentin Grimes as well. So I think that this team is looking good, and I'm very excited to see what they can bring to the floor and this season if they can make it all the way through the playoffs. That's a big deal. That'll come later. But yeah, that's my thoughts. I guess we should move on to the trivia section. And like I said, you can enjoy this interview in a little bit. Alex gave me a number question last time. I'm going to give him a number question this time. This is how it works. Steve Nash, the head coach of the Brooklyn Nets, had a famous number that he played with his whole career. Now, would you like options or you know it right off the bat, Alex?
Options.
Options. This is a Hall of Famer. This is an 8-time All-Star. Steve yes. Nash, do you know his number? The options are, was he number 8, number 10, number 13, or number 17?
10. Wait, is he not 10?
Okay, I should have said this. His famous number, that's true.
Oh, didn't he play as 10 at one point?
He did play as 10. So, I mean, yeah. That was on me. Congrats to you. You got 10.
Partial credit.
He played 10 seasons with the Phoenix Suns, 6 seasons with the Dallas Mavericks, 2 seasons with the Los Angeles Lakers. When he was on the Los Angeles Lakers for those final 2 seasons, his number was number 10.
But obviously, and that's what I remember of him, obviously, since I'm not old enough to remember.
That otherwise. Is very true. Although, obviously, his Hall of Fame years did come with the Phoenix Suns and Dallas Mavericks. So,
I mean, what were the other 3 options?
8, 13, 17.
It's 8, right?
13.
Really?
Yeah.
Jeez, all right. Interesting.
So, yeah, so there's a trivia question that was executed not the best. Alex, what you got for the Knicks trivia?
To be fair, he was never a net, so... Not, you know.
He's the Nets head coach.
Yeah, but not... All right.
You the got Knicks. It right. I don't know why you're so... I mean, you
well, got I got part of it right.
Partial credit.
The Knicks, in the 1980s, had mixed success. Kind of as they have had recently.
Mm.
That included how many playoff appearances? Would you like multiple choice or would you like to guess a number? Obviously, multiple choice because that's easier, correct?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I have a number in my head.
2, 4, 6, or 8.
I have 6 in my mind, and that's what I was going to say prior, but what is it?
It is 6. You are correct.
I should have said it. I would have looked so much better.
You would have looked so much better.
I would have looked so much better. Wow. All right, well, that's what it is. We want to let you enjoy this interview with Ian Eagle. And we will see you whenever we see you for another episode of the City That Never Sleeps podcast. So we are now joined by a very special guest. He's the TV play-by-play voice for the Brooklyn Nets, as well as the NBA games on TNT. He's also the TV play-by-play voice for the NFL on CBS alongside Charles Davis. And you can also hear him for NCAA college basketball, March Madness especially. That's where all the grind happens for Mr. Ian Eagle. How are you doing?
Hey, great to see you guys, Josh. Alex, nice to be on with you. Everything's great. I mean, what could be bad? We're just days away from this season getting underway. I know you guys are excited, and this is always a really fun time just paying attention to the league and getting into the mindset that we got the next, 5 months and change to really break down the NFL. So everything's great. Thank you.
Yeah, and obviously NFL, and then later in the year, we'll have basketball back as well, so that's exciting. And I know that's going to be exciting for you as well. I guess we'll get into going backwards a little bit. We always do this with people, kind of go back into the past, start from the beginning, try to figure people out. So, you know, obviously your father worked in the entertainment business. And how did that kind of affect you and like inspire you to go into that business as well? Obviously a little bit different types of roles, but how'd that affect you?
Yeah, we're going way back.
Way back.
I got to get like deep, deep into the recesses of my mind. It affected everything. It set a tone in my life that not doing the normal 9-to-5 thing would be acceptable within my family. And when that's ingrained in you in a young age, you really think that the possibilities are endless. So my dad was a comedian, musician, actor. My mom was a singer and an actress. And that's the only life I knew from the day I was put on this earth until the day my mom passed away and my dad passed away. That's the life that I was familiar with. And that seemed normal, even though I know from my friends and the people that I got to know as a kid, that was anything but normal in their particular lives. And for me, when I told them that I wanted to be a broadcaster, they were so encouraging. And that empowered me to go out and do it. I was only 8 years old when I knew what I wanted to do, and I articulated it to both of them. And they both said, well, then that's what you'll do. So when it was that matter of fact, it seemed very attainable. And I was able to really put my focus on going out and trying to make it as a broadcaster and not worry about the family reaction of, no, be a lawyer, be a doctor, do anything else. They were very supportive in that. And I think that really paved the way for me thinking in a positive manner and believing that I could actually go out and achieve it.
I have a another question here that is, I don't want to call it like a softball, but I'm sure it's either the answer of, you know, there's not a specific and it's every single one that I love, but I do have to ask the question of, is there a favorite sport that you do love to call and it like really is in your heart?
I don't know if I could answer it definitively because I really don't have that answer. I've been doing these two sports for so long that they very much are a part of my day-to-day life. I think about the NFL and I think about the NBA every single day of the year in some way. College basketball flashes in and it dominates my calendar for a period of time. And then for the most part, I turn it off and then I get back into the mindset for it when it's time to get refocused. But football and basketball are just dominant parts of my existence. And if you put me in a football stadium to call a big NFL game or to do a radio game, I have the same energy, enthusiasm, and passion as I would going in to call a big NBA game or a midweek NBA game locally, nationally, whatever it might be. And then the NCAA tournament, I must say, that brings it to this other level because there's so much work involved. There's so much preparation. And the way I've always viewed it, I've done the tournament since 1998. So we're talking about 24 NCAA tournaments, albeit, as we know, 2020 didn't happen. So 23 total tournaments, 24-year period where it was a thought in my mind every March. I take a lot of pride in making sure that the kids, the players, they're 18, 19, 20, 21, sometimes a little older than that they get their just due, that they've gotten to this stage, which is for many of them, the biggest stage they'll ever be on. And I just want to make sure that I tell their story correctly. And while that might sound or feel a bit cliche, I do feel that sort of pressure in my mind when I do these games, that their family is watching, that one day they'll watch this game back with their kids or their grandkids. And the hope is that the announcer was on top of it and did a really good job of telling that story and being a conduit for the kind of drama that you get in those moments to the audience. And it goes down in history. These NCAA tournaments to me mean something every year somebody else emerges that you didn't expect. And you want to make sure that you're doing yeoman's work in that area and that you've got it covered.
I also wanted to ask you, because Alex and I attended the sports broadcasting camp hosted by Dave Popkin and Tim Capture, yeah, where you spoke. And, you know, I don't remember the story, and that's why I want you to retell it, because I really just remember the funniest part, where I believe you were talking about when you called your first boxing match, I think. And the person you were calling it with, when you told them you were having lunch with them, and you told them, yeah, this is my first time, and he thought you were joking. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, so that's under the umbrella of saying yes, of getting into that mentality of, if someone offers you something, don't hesitate, don't overthink it, don't overanalyze it. Say yes, and then do everything in your power to prepare yourself to go out and do it. So I've had that a few times in my career where I've done sports that I hadn't done before, obviously, when you're doing it for the first time. Golf, first time I ever called golf, I was at the Masters, and it was the first golf event I ever attended. And for many people, I recognize the idea of just going to the Masters would be a lifelong dream come true. And for me, I was working the event, and I had to familiarize myself and make sure that I was prepared. Track and field, same situation. Had never been to a track and field event. Ended up calling track and field the outdoor championships in the NCAA for 8 years until CBS lost the rights to ESPN. Tennis, same deal. Volleyball, on and on. So boxing, I got a phone call in 2000. It was right after my third NCAA tournament. So 98, 99, 2000, I had done now two NFL seasons. And the woman that called me said, hey, Ian, you do boxing, right? So that's a bit of a leading question. I said, oh, yeah, I do the hell out of boxing. Are you kidding me? Great. We've got four fights for you. And I went out to Vegas to call the first fight. I called the producer, told him, hey, send me whatever you got. This is back when we had VHS tapes. And he sent me 60 hours of boxing coverage from CBS from previous years. And I poured through the tapes and I started jotting down notes, vocabulary, nomenclature, how you use certain terms, all of it, and studied the sport. I was a fan of boxing, so I had a working knowledge. And I go into Vegas, I'm getting ready for the fight. It's Obed Sullivan against David Tua. And my boss, who happened to be in Vegas, completely unrelated to the boxing match, for a convention, said, hey, I want to take you to lunch. So we go to lunch, and he had a chicken Caesar salad. I had chicken wings. I don't eat very well. I eat like a 12-year-old. And as he's eating his lunch at the MGM Grand, he said, well, tell me about your boxing experience. And I said, well, Terry, his name's Terry Ewert. I said, Terry, I've never called a fight. He said, really? And I said, Terry, look, let's just be honest here. I've never been to a fight. And now I see little beads of sweat forming above his lip. And he said, really? And a little more concerned in his, the first really was inquisitive. Really? Second really was more like, really? And then I said, Terry, I've never been in a fight. So I have no background in any of this, which wasn't completely true. In fifth grade, somehow I ended up having to fight some kid. I still don't know why. I had no beef with him, but I was told during the day, like at noon, hey, I heard you're fighting James Schneff at 3 o'clock. I'm like, really? Am I? I didn't get the memo. I had no idea. And I had to fight the guy after school, and I threw a punch. I closed my eyes. I was wearing large, thick winter gloves. I connected. He went down. I walked home. I got a slice of pizza. Anyway, I call the fight. The fight ends up going 2 minutes and 38 seconds in the first round. But we called an undercard, which was a 12-round fight. And after the fight, Terry came out of the broadcast truck and said, were you joking with me? I cleaned it up a little bit. I said, no, I wasn't joking. That was the first one. So it really is under the whole theme that I said yes. When I was asked about it, I said yes, and it gave me a new experience. I ended up calling four fights for CBS. I had some other opportunities down the road. I couldn't make it work in my schedule, with another network that was interested in using me. And the fact of the matter is, if I don't say yes, then I never get that chance. And if you never get that chance, you never find out if you can actually go do it.
So obviously you prepared a lot more for your first time doing boxing coverage, but yeah. With NBA, with NFL, what's the process like for preparing? Obviously, it's different with the NBA because you have a limited time to prepare compared to the NFL, where you have the whole week, usually in most circumstances, where NBA, you have a day or two. How do you prepare differently for each of those events?
Yeah, great question. NFL, you're building towards an event. So each day you're chipping away. My goal on Monday is to put my previous week's game behind me, turn the page, and start to really get the skeleton of the board that I will use for each team. My week one game is Buffalo and Pittsburgh. So Monday of that game, I'll start filling in some of the blanks. Who's where? Starting offense, backup offense, starting defense, backup defense. And then as the week goes on, I'm still accumulating notes each day for each team. And I'm doing it in a very general way. And then by Friday, I start to hone in and try to get those larger notes into a smaller type of folder so that I can now digest it and present it when I need it. And it's a lot of notes, but not all of it makes air. Saturday is more of the personal connection with the team, talking to the coach, talking to players, and then using those notes to enhance the broadcast on Sunday, personalizing it in some way. We spoke with Coach Tomlin. He told us this. We sat down with Josh Allen. He mentioned this, trying to go beyond what's been in the newspaper all week or on websites and get a little bit more specific with the matchup, with the storylines. And then Sunday, obviously, you got to let it rip. And all the prep that you did, it's a combination of your preparation and your performance. And you've got to be able to combine and marry those two worlds. If you've prepared well, it allows you to perform better. If you have not prepared well, odds are your performance is going to suffer because you don't really know your stuff, and vice versa. If you don't perform well, your preparation means very little. You could have all the information, but if you're not presenting it in a way that can be understood by the audience, then you're not doing your job. So I try to remind myself of that every week with the NFL. You're building towards this big event. And then you get 3 hours and you get no do-overs. You get one take on these calls. That's it. So you've got to be sharp. You've got to be highly immersed in what you're doing. And your concentration level has to be at an all-time high every week. No matter what's happening in your life, whether you got a good night's sleep, whether your kid is sick, whether you had a bad seatmate on your flight, nobody cares. Nobody's concerned. They're only concerned about the participants in that game. Are you identifying them correctly? And are you doing a good job of conveying the drama and emotion in the game that you're covering? That's your job. That's it. So that's how I focus in on football. Basketball, it's a bit more superfluous. I'm doing the Nets game, so I've got a board that I've done, and I update throughout the season with the Nets, but the general information. What year is the player in? What college did he go to? What's his height? What's his weight? What's his age? What's his hometown? What year was he drafted? What draft pick was he? How was he acquired by the team? All of that is basic rudimentary stuff. Then you delve deeper. Scouting report. What does he like to do? What's his reputation in the league? How much money does he make? What are his shooting percentages that season for his career? All of it, college career, go deeper, high school career. Is there more? I'm always looking for more. It's all about in-depth, going beyond the obvious. And that I've gotten down to a science. You know, I could probably do one team based on the information that I've collected through the years and new information that I'm updating. I can probably knock out one team, that general information, in 4 hours or so, give or take, depending on the team. So now you have to budget your time in the week when I've got three NBA games and two NFL games, because I often do a Thursday game on radio. You've got to be really smart in how you compartmentalize and how you balance your schedule through the week. Every waking moment that I have to prepare, I use. That's how I view it. That's part of the job. And if you're not doing it that way and you can sleep soundly on Saturday night before your game, more power to you. I would not be able to. I need to know that I've got every stone covered and nothing has been left unturned when it's time to do the game.
So kind of alluding to what you were saying, because you were going on to that already, is your talking points. You know, when it comes to NFL versus NBA, there's the 15-man roster in the NBA. There's a 53-man roster in the yep. NFL. When you're talking about, you know, kind of saying at a Nets game, Nick Claxton, he's gonna play. He won't have as many minutes as a Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, but he's gonna right. play. So let's get two or three talking points on there. Say where he was born, or you know where he went to high school. Where this third string backup left tackle, he maybe comes in if the starting left tackle unfortunately gets injured, but most likely he won't come in. So how many talking points when it comes to that? Like, do you have just two or three bullet points and kind of narrow that down? Like, how does that work with how many talking points you have for each player?
All right, let's take the Giants as an example. I believe this is a team close to both of your hearts. Is that a fair assessment?
Perfect example. You're right on the dot.
Right on the dot. So Daniel Jones, how many nuggets will I have on Daniel Jones for a given game? On my main board, I could have up to 15 different notes on Daniel Jones. I might use two. On my secondary board, I might have nine more stat specific or matchup specific. For Andrew Thomas, I might have 12 notes. The odds of me going with 12 notes for a starting tackle are slim to none. A backup tackle, I might have 4 notes just in case. And it's a fear, and I don't know where it stems from, but it's a fear that I had early in my career that I did not want to be put in a position that a player enters the game and I've got nothing. So while I accept that it's requiring more time of me during the week for the 53rd, 52nd, 51st, 50th, 49th, 48th man on the roster to make sure that I've done my due diligence and gotten 3, 4, 5 nuggets on them, I sleep better at night knowing that I did. That if that occurrence takes place, as you said, third string lineman has to come in, what do I have? Well, I've got the basics. That goes without saying, because everybody's covered on height, weight, age, years in the league, college, what year they were drafted, all of that. But can you go a little deeper? Do you find something from their high school days? Do you find something that their parents did? Do you find something connected to them in some way? And that's where I think broadcasters can separate themselves from other broadcasters. Is it dead air? Or do you have something of value that would be of interest to the viewer? And that's how I've always tried to tackle it.
So looking back in the past, do you have like a favorite game you've called? I guess one from the NFL and one from the NBA, maybe even one from March Madness.
Yeah. I mean, sure, there are games that stand out in my career that are embedded in my head that certainly made a mark. And I look back on and realize I was really fortunate to be there in that position. NBA Finals. I don't know if you guys ended up watching the Michael Jordan documentary during the pandemic. It was impressive. It was well done. And I was fortunate enough to call the world feed on the NBA Finals for a bunch of years. And one of them was that the Bulls Jazz series when Jordan hit the shot over Brian Russell in Salt Lake City. And I was calling that game on a world feed. So the game went to the United Kingdom and Israel and Indonesia, Philippines, different areas around the world. And that game was incredible. Just the shift in emotion and the high level of play with Stockton and Malone and Jordan hitting the game-winning shot, which ended up being his final shot as a member of the Chicago Bulls. So history as well. And to think back on that and to be in this in attendance to call that one meant a whole lot. NCAA tournament, again, the world feed. I called the NCAA championship for Butler, Duke. Gordon Hayward had a chance to win the game with a half-court shot against Duke. I don't believe for a second that anything would have been considered a greater upset than that in college basketball history. NC State beating Houston, huge. Villanova, Georgetown, huge. Butler over Duke would have been right there with them. And if the game ended on a half-court shot by Hayward in Indianapolis, his basically hometown, Butler's located there, and they beat Duke, one of the top programs of all time, it would have been maybe the greatest ending in college basketball history. So it was that close, but it was a fantastic game to call. It was another high-level game and one that really stands out. NFL, I think it's still to come. I don't believe I've done it yet. I believe there will be a game that becomes the game for me. You know, I've called so many Tom Brady games. I've called so many Peyton Manning games. My first game for CBS NFL was Peyton Manning's first game as a professional. So to usher in that career, Hall of Fame career, and to do it in my first broadcast was very memorable. But I think there's an NFL game down the road that'll probably go down as my favorite.
This is a personal question because I'm always interested when they show either now with social media recently, you're able to kind of put in videos for like a Twitter video in a broadcast. So this always interests me. Is this in your research? Or let's just say, for example, obviously, I think it's Steve Nash is it Steve Nash is RJ Barrett's godfather?
He is.
Right. So like, let's just say, I don't know, is this you like telling your producer and saying, hey, let's get a picture of RJ Barrett in his childhood taking a picture with Steve Nash while he's in the NBA? Or is that your producer in a meeting before the game saying, hey, in the transition between the first and second quarter, we're going to show this clip? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, Josh, glad you asked that. It is organic often, and it is collaborative. So my Nets producer, Frank DeGrace, I've worked with for over 20 years. We share a brain during these broadcasts. And the way he's thinking is often the way that I'm thinking. And there are a lot of checks and balances in there. He knows what I'm thinking. I know where he's going a lot of the time. And in that particular case, if it's something that I uncover in my notes prior, and I think it's something that we could have some fun with, yes, I'll alert him, a text, and then let him take care of it within our crew of getting the photo. Then he can decide the best time to use it. And there are times where he notices something in his prep, he'll text me, hey, heads up, I'm getting this. So you may want to do a little background. Yes, perfect, great. If you can prepare me and I can now go out and do my own homework, even better. If you want to write something up, which sometimes happens based on my schedule, hey, I decided to do this. I wrote something up. Here you go. I check it out. And then when they pop it into the broadcast, I'm prepared for it. So it really is a codependent relationship once you get to that level where you really have a strong working dynamic with the people that you're doing these games with. NFL, I've now been with my producer, Mark Wolf, for almost 8 years. So you build up a real trust and understanding. We have a conversation early in the week about some things that have already interested me in the matchup. And then he'll fill me in on what other ideas may have popped up. And I think what ends up happening on a really good television crew is you recognize and acknowledge that a good idea can come from anywhere. And everybody's got a voice. If you're the stat person, if you're the stage manager, if you're the audio person, if you're the graphics person, if you're in videotape, if you've got a good idea and you have a really good producer, then everybody feels encouraged to share. And the goal is to have a great broadcast and to provide entertainment and information and any way that you can do it. Sometimes it's a circuitous route. It's not always direct. But if you can get there and get people something that they didn't know or something to make them laugh or something to maybe tug at their heartstrings, then you've done your job. And I like to think, I hope the people that I work with know that that's my goal. And my goal every broadcast is to find a different angle and find a little something different. And everybody feels empowered to bring something to the table.
So this past weekend, you called the Jets preseason game. And obviously there was that Hail Mary at the end with the two-point conversion to tie the game there. So it's weird, right? Because it's preseason. So you can't get like too excited. You can't go too crazy. But then you also need to make it entertaining. Like how do you find the balance between that?
Yeah, Alex, for me, I have always viewed it as you've got to go out and deliver. That's your job. If you're a passive observer in the broadcasting role, then you're not doing the game justice. And I just know if I was at home watching, even in a preseason game, a last play of the game, that means nothing, that eventually people will forget about. But if it would lift me out of my seat and make me jump up, then as an announcer, if I'm not conveying that, then I'm failing at my job. I'm supposed to be an extension of the audience in some way. I happen to have a microphone on and a headset and a pretty good view of the game. So I have to be genuine in the moment. And my genuine reaction, even in a game that meant very little, was it's a Hail Mary. And a Hail Mary is exciting no matter what. So I called it, you know, did I call it like it was the Super Bowl? No. But did I give it a little extra oomph because it's pretty special? Yeah. And for James Morgan, it might be his greatest NFL highlight. We don't know in his career. He might look back on that thing and say, man, that's the best thing I ever did on an NFL field. Yeah, maybe Morgan eventually evolves and develops into something, but there's a chance that might be the high point for him.
Our final question for you. Once again, I feel like I'm just talking about myself now. Once again, kind of comes back to me as like I'm starting to try, you know, calling games. I've been doing MBA, or I did do MBA. I haven't done really many over the summer because there haven't been any MBA games besides the summer league. And I tried it, you know, saying quote unquote, like I'm on radio, and I listening back constantly hear myself saying too much, I guess is the word. I'm kind of rushing through and then I, you know, maybe I pull up a stat and then I miss something here or there that happens during the game. So you're on TV. So it's a little bit different. It's a little bit different story, but my question for you is how do you kind of navigate through calling an NBA game, knowing when to like let it ride when there's three pointer after three pointer down the court, or when to commentate the most and kind of get everything in at once?
Yeah, I think this is often the biggest challenge for broadcasters, Josh, is striking that right balance on TV. Am I talking too much? Am I taking away from the action? On radio, am I talking enough, or am I giving too much information? Am I overloading the listener? Think about a blank canvas. And if you started drawing a picture and you give it some texture and you go with the background and now you have something in the foreground. But if you just fill every little space with something, and as an admirer of it, I might say, wow, there's a lot going on there. And that's the same as a radio broadcast. If it's too much, the listener can get overwhelmed. So finding the right amount of description is paramount to that job, and how you use your voice and your pace. You know, I've tried to tell young broadcasters, don't let the action dictate your pace. You're always in charge of your pace. So there might be a wild sequence. As long as you keep your cool and keep describing it, you can remain under control and not allow whatever's happening on the field or the court or the ice to be too much for you and too much for the listener. I think that's often the biggest challenge for young broadcasters to figure out. And you don't want to get in the way. You're there to complement the action. You're there to enhance the experience. If you're getting in the way of the experience, then you're not doing your job correctly. So that's really my 10-cent assessment of it, especially if you're starting out. Just remember, would I be interested in this if I was listening? And when you play back your play-by-play and you close your eyes, can I visualize what's happening on the radio? And does it interest me? Am I mesmerized by what this person is saying? Do I get lost in it? Or after a minute, do I say, too much happening. I'm going to move on and listen to something else. So that requires a lot of self-assessment. And that's really important when you're starting out in the broadcasting industry.
Ian Eagle, thank you so much for joining us, Alex. And I really do appreciate it. You can stay in touch with all of Ian Eagle's work on CBS. And thank you for mentioning that, because I did not mention it in the intro, on Westwood One, Thursday Night Football as well. Brooklyn Nets on Yes Network and March Madness during March on CBS as well. Thank you so much.
Josh, Alex, a pleasure. Good luck to your Giants. I know you're expecting big things. So hopefully this is the season for Danny Dimes and company.
Welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast.
I'm Bill.
And I'm Jason. And this is the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. So whether you're a brain, a jock, a valley girl, or a Jedi, we've got some 80s classics for you.
Do these movies stand the test of time? Are we discovering something new? Is there an 80s movie we're finally watching for the first time?
Join us each week as we dive into the cinematic nostalgia that inspired and influenced a generation. From the hits to the cult classics, we'll discuss our earliest memories, favorite scenes, fun facts, and our not-so-favorite movie moments, too.
It's the All 80s Movies Podcast, now available on all major streaming platforms. Please subscribe and happy listening.